All right, good morning. Welcome to everyone here. We're going to be in Romans chapter 1 this morning. Romans chapter 1. And before we get started, we'll have a prayer. I have not called on anyone, so I will do a cold call here. Nelson, would you like to lead us in prayer before we start? So the book of Romans is all about the gospel, and I think most of you probably know the gospel is all about the good news of what Jesus has done for us. So funny thing, if you look at the Greek word, though, which I will not try to pronounce, but the Greek word for gospel, another way to translate it is good herald. Good herald. Think about back in ancient times. What would a herald be used for? Well, a lot of times it's used to, to proclaim news. Like if a general's won a great battle and he wants the citizens of the town to know, what does he do? Well, there's no newspaper to print it on. There's no internet to post it on. You send out a herald to the town square to announce what's already been done. And in the same sense, that's what the gospel is. It's news about what's already been done for us by Jesus. It's announcing a victory that's already been completed. So that's what the book of Romans is about. I would divide, this is not original to me, but I've heard someone divide the book of Romans into four main parts, which I think makes sense. One is about the wrath of God. Chapter is about 1-3, talking about how we've sinned and fallen short of his glory. So one, the wrath of God. Two, it's about the grace of God. Here you get into chapters 4-8, roughly, talking about how we can be saved. Then three, it's about the plan of God. This is about chapters 9-11, roughly, talking about Jews and Gentiles and how we got to this point. How did the plan of God unfold over time? So you've got the plan of God. And then four, you've got the will of God. This is going to be chapters about 12-16, talking about how do we live then as Christians, given that Christ has paid the price for our sin, how then should we live? So if you're keeping track, it's the wrath of God, the grace of God, the plan of God, and then the will of God. So that's what we're going to be doing for the rest of this year on Sunday morning. Jason and I are splitting the classes. We'll each take about half in random order. So let's talk about the background of the book. When was Romans written? Where was Romans written? As far as we can tell, obviously, from historical sources and infer from the biblical narrative, what's the background on the book of Romans? Anyone? Yes.
Teaching tour seems that he was probably in the city of Corinth when he wrote it. Some of the individuals that he references both in Romans and 1 Corinthians tend to put those pieces together. That seems to be the setting.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. About 57 AD is the date, 56 to 57 AD is the date that I've seen most frequently. Probably on the third missionary journey, Corinth is a good bet. Now, what strikes me about this is Paul's mindset at the time. This corresponds, the third missionary journey around Corinth, corresponds to Acts chapter 20. If you look at the end of Acts chapter 20, when Paul's saying goodbye to the Ephesian elders, what does he say to them, or why do they weep so much when Paul's departing? Exactly, yeah. So Paul knows that his life is about to change. In Acts chapter 21, he's arrested in Jerusalem, eventually sent to Rome. So Paul knows that his life is changing. So I think that makes Romans an especially interesting book because this is the end of an era, so to speak, for him. He's gone on the first missionary journey, the second journey, the third journey free. I would assume he has a sense that that's about to change. So this is like, in my mind, an encapsulation of all the doctrine, all the theology that he's been teaching up to this point. So he knows things are about to change in his life. And so that makes Romans, I think, a great encapsulation of what the gospel message is. What does salvation mean? What does grace mean? What does faith mean? These are things that are all covered really well in the book of Romans. So that's the background of the book. That's the setting in which Paul is writing this. Now let's get into chapter 1. We're going to look at chapter 1 this morning. Then chapter 2 I'll do next week. Then Jason will take 3 week after that. So chapter 1. Could I get someone to read verses 1 through 7 here? Romans 1, 1 through 7. So here you have the introduction to the book. And right off the top, you'll notice 3 essential claims that Paul makes, especially in verse 1. I would characterize these 3 ways. 1, there's a claim to identity. How does Paul introduce himself? Yeah, of Jesus. Yeah, exactly. I don't know about you. I've never introduced myself this way. When someone asks me who I am, I'll just say my last name, you know, to link myself to my family. Or maybe that. Or another time, there's someone I know who's blind, and sometimes when I walk up to her and I see her around the hill, I'll introduce myself as RJ from the office because, you know, that's where I work. I don't know why I do that, because there's not many RJs running around D.C. But I've never introduced myself as RJ as a bondservant, a servant, someone who serves Jesus. But Paul sees this as absolutely essential to who his, what his identity is. 2, there's a claim to authority here. How do you think there's a claim to authority? Yeah. Have you ever heard someone say, well, Jesus never said anything about this, therefore it's okay? How would you respond to that? Jesus never said not to do this, or Jesus never said to do this, so it's okay. How would you respond to that? Jesus' literal words. Jesus literally never spoke these things. Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So
what you have here is, you know, one of the things that Jesus did say to his apostles was he was going to provide help and he was going to prove. And they wrote those things down. Mm-hmm. So all truth is a combination of what Christ individually said as well as what the Holy Spirit revealed and inspired.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what Jesus did say to the apostles is that all authority has been given to you on heaven and on earth. So here's Paul making a direct claim that I am an apostle of Jesus Christ. Yes.
You said that he said to the apostles,
all authority. Did I get that? Did I misquote that?
Yeah.
What's the actual quote? Sorry.
He
has all authority. I got that backwards. Sorry. So he has all authority, and then he commanded them to go out and teach men to be saved, being baptized in the name of the Holy Spirit. Yes, thank you. I got that backwards. So there's a claim of authority here at the very beginning of the book. Now, the third thing here is a claim to purpose. You've got a claim to identity, a claim to authority, and then a claim to purpose. Notice what he says in the middle of the verse, near the end of the verse. It says, set apart for the gospel of God. It's not from something else. A lot of times when we're Christians, we're saying, we're set apart from all this evil. And that's true. We are set apart from things of the world. But Paul doesn't see his identity in a negative. He doesn't define himself by what he's against. He's saying, I'm set apart for the gospel. I have a special purpose in my life. So that's how he sets up the book. So let's look now at the next section. I know we're skipping over some verses here, but there's a lot of content here that it's hard to cover in an hour. So let's look at verses 8 through 15. Somebody read that. Yeah, in the back. So I sent out a question on this. How do you see Paul's relationship to the saints? What did he want to do for them? What did he see as his obligation or his duty to them? I pulled out three things. There could be more than three. But to your mind, verses 8 through 15, what does Paul want to do for the saints in Rome?
Yeah, that's all three. The first one being thank God for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And in a broader sense, just pray for them. Be grateful for them. Keep them in your prayers. That, to me, I think, is incredibly special because when you look at a lot of these epistles, Paul's constantly talking about how he's constantly in prayer, pray without ceasing. It's clearly a huge part of his life. Sometimes I wonder, how did he have time to do anything else if he's constantly in prayer for all these saints and all of these different churches? So he's constantly praying for everyone, yes. What else is he doing here? He's telling the good news about Jesus, yes. Which verse were you looking at for that? Verse 9? Yeah, absolutely. I would say verse 14 is kind of the same idea that he's under obligation to everyone to preach the gospel, he says at the end of verse 15. That raises an interesting point in my mind. Verse 14, he says, I'm under obligation both to Greeks and to barbarians. Kind of a unique verb choice. Why do you think he says obligation? Why does he say, I'm under obligation to Jews, to Gentiles, to preach the gospel? Yeah. Either one of you, sorry.
The gospel's for everyone.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, absolutely. When it comes to obligation, I think there are two ways that you can incur an obligation. One is to have a debt. Like, if I have a $100 loan from someone else, then I have an obligation or I have a duty to pay that back. That's one way you have an obligation. The other way, I think, is that you have a duty. You have a duty. For example, someone has given you $100 to pass on to someone else. Now, the loan isn't for you, but you still have a duty to pass that along because that's been entrusted to you, that $100. And I think that's what Paul is saying here. I've been entrusted with a gift that's extremely special, and I have a duty to pass that along to other people. Like James said, no matter who they are, no matter where they're from, I have this obligation. So I think that's what he's talking about in verse 14. So we've hit two of them. Pray for them, thank God for them. Also, we need to talk about preaching the gospel, sharing that with other Christians. There's one more thing I think that we haven't hit on, maybe more than that, but there's one that I had written down that, yeah, Aaron, you look like you're about to say something.
Strengthen them or encourage them.
Yeah. And that's half the story. Yes, he wanted to encourage them. What else? What's the other half? Impart a spiritual gift. Yes, Debbie. Yes. Yes, yes, I love that. See, a lot of times we think of Paul as this super Christian who had everything figured out and never needed any help. Paul wanted to go and be encouraged by them. Verse 12, he says, that we may be mutually encouraged by each other's faith, both yours and mine. So, if you walk into church sometimes thinking, I haven't had a great week and I could really need to be built up right now, don't think that means I'm not a Christian or my faith just must not be strong enough, because Paul came to church meetings like this wanting to be encouraged by what the other saints were doing. Even someone who had as many gifts, seen as many things, knew as much as Paul, still needed the fellowship of brethren around him. So, what does that require? Well, a couple things. For one, it requires that church attendance be a priority in your life. A lot of times we go to Hebrews and cite the verse that says, don't forsake the assembly of the saints together. That's great. You know, you shouldn't forsake the assembly. But a lot of times people take that to think, well, it's a rule. We got to be here. If I'm not here, Greg and Tony are going to call me. So I guess I better show up. Okay, what's a better attitude to have about that? You see it exactly here in verse 12 of Romans chapter 1. If you see church as attendance as a rule, you're never going to get much out of it. You're never going to be that encouraged. Let's look at the opposite perspective. If you come here determined, I'm going to be encouraged today, it's a decent chance you will be. What if you came in the door saying, I'm going to encourage one person today? Just one person. Do you think you could do that? I figure you could. I think anyone can encourage at least one person around them when they come to church in the morning. So, if you want to be mutually encouraged by other people's faith, the first step to doing that is being willing to be present and to be a part of the body. So that's what you see happening in verses 8 through 14. Okay, so now we get into what in my mind is one of the thesis statements of the book, maybe the main thesis statement of the book, which is verses 16 through 17. So, who would like to read 16 through 17? Yeah, John. Yep. Okay. So, I sent out a question about this as well. Think about Paul's personal story. Why do you think Paul theoretically could be ashamed of the gospel? Not just people in general, but Paul in particular. Think about his background, his story. Why do you think theoretically Paul might be ashamed of the gospel? Yeah, he persecuted people, so clearly at one point he was ashamed of the gospel. Yes, Tony. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. What else? Wait.
And like what I said earlier about being under an obligation to the Gentiles, when he first came to Christ, Ananias told him what was prophesied against him, that he would be the one to carry the gospel to the Gentiles, and that he would suffer many things because of what he was doing. So he's known from the beginning that his ministry was going to cause him to suffer.
Yep. Yep, absolutely. I think these are, yeah, Nathan.
Going on with everything that
Yeah. I mean, think about Paul's education. Who educated him, or how was he educated, so far as we know? At feet of Gamaliel, and what would Gamaliel have taught him? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So when Paul is taking a stand for the gospel, he's rejecting his education, he's rejecting the culture that he grew up in, he's rejecting a lot of things, but he thinks it's worth it for the surpassing worth of Christ. Think about us. In today's terms, why do you think that we might be ashamed of the gospel? What might strike us as shameful about the gospel? Another. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. One more, and then keep going. There is not one more.
Well, yes. 22, I think, DC, there's a connection that in their society and in ours, there are people who think they're too wise to believe in God, they're too wise to believe in the idea of moral rights and wrong, or sin and righteousness, and you can be looked down on, or we can be looked down on if you come to be ashamed that they do.
Yeah, absolutely. I think all those are true. I wrote down three things here to answer why we might be ashamed of the gospel. Some of them kind of touch on what we've already discussed. But one, it tells us we're spiritual failures. It tells us that we have a need that we can't meet. It reveals that there's a rescue, a redemption that we didn't purchase ourselves. And in our self-sufficient society, where we think we can do everything ourselves, we can pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps, this is a radical idea that we're spiritual failures and there's nothing that we can do about it apart from Jesus and his completed work on the cross. So that's one reason it might be offensive. Two, it's exclusive. Jesus said in John 14, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." So it offends modern notions that we can find God in our own way, or that everyone has their own path to God the Father. So the gospel is exclusive. Three, the gospel requires self-denial. Like some of the comments said, Jesus saved us by suffering and serving people, not by setting up an earthly kingdom, not by conquering people, not by destroying different nations. So what does that mean for us? It means that the people who follow him are going to live a life that looks the same. It's not going to be a life of ruling over other people or crushing other nations. It's going to be a life of suffering and service if you want to follow Jesus. So that requires self-denial, which, again, in our culture, not a hugely popular concept. So those are three reasons that we could be ashamed of the gospel. And this is a mindset, you probably noticed, that is to a large degree creeped into mainstream Christianity. You might have seen in February of this year, there was a Barna poll that reported almost half of Christian millennials, self-identified Christian millennials, 47% agree at least somewhat that it is wrong to share one's personal beliefs with someone of a different faith in hopes that they will one day share the same faith. Or in other words, 47% of self-identified Christians say it's wrong to evangelize. Not just I have difficulty evangelizing, not just it makes me nervous or I'm intimidated. 47% self-identified Christian millennials say it's morally wrong to try to convert other people to the Lord. That's what it looks like when you're ashamed of the gospel. When you're ashamed of the gospel, you don't want to share it with other people or tell them that this is the way, the truth, and the life, or that this is the way to salvation. So, why should we be unashamed of the gospel? I'll give you three reasons. There's more than three reasons, but I'll give you three reasons why Paul is right, I think, and that we should be unashamed to spread the news of Jesus with other people. One, people know the world is broken. This is not a surprise to anyone. This is not a surprise to people in Paul's time in Rome, in the city that he was writing to. Seneca, one of the famous leaders in Rome, once wrote that, quote, Rome is a cesspool of iniquity. One of their famous poets, Juvenalis, said, Rome is a filthier sewer into which the dregs of the empire flood. So even people who are worldly, these are not Christians, these are not believers, even people who were worldly during Paul's time recognized that Rome had a problem. It was unbelievably powerful, one of the greatest empires the world had ever seen. But something was missing, right? There was a morality, there was a way of life that was totally missing from the streets of Rome. And so if even unbelievers can see that, people opposed to Jesus, even if they can see that something is missing, even amid that power and wealth, then Paul's saying, I'm not ashamed to say, this is a problem, and I have the answer to it. Paul's saying, I'm not ashamed to point out that Rome has some problems with morality, and that people need to live better lives, because even you realize that this is an issue. So that's one reason I think that Paul isn't ashamed. Two, other people were not and are not afraid to share their beliefs. If you've ever noticed, other people are not afraid to tell you what they believe. Other people are not afraid a lot of times to tell you what you should believe. So if other people are not afraid to share their beliefs, then we shouldn't be afraid to share our beliefs with them as well. And I think that's true of Paul in Romans chapter 1. He knew that other people were sharing their messages, and so he wasn't afraid to do the same. And then three, we shouldn't be ashamed of the gospel because ultimately Jesus wasn't ashamed to go to the cross for us. And I think that's really where it all begins and ends. Jesus took the cross of our shame and carried that so that we can be saved. And so how could we ever be ashamed of the gospel, of the good news, of what Jesus has already done? And I think Paul realized that. He realized that Jesus had gone to the cross, not just for Christians in general, but for him personally. Jesus had paid the debt for him, just like he has for you and me. Bill.
And that, of course, Paul's message in Galatians 2 is pointed that he's been crucified with Christ. Mm-hmm. And the life I now live, ultimately not our message.
Yep.
Everyone else is sharing their opinions. Everyone else is sharing their notions of things. They may be based in fact. They may be wholly irrational and made up by their own lives and prejudices. The point is, we're not bringing our message. And we need to make sure we're not bringing our message. We need to get out of the way of the gospel and let Jesus and his Holy Spirit convict people of sin and salvation. And that's the point. It's not our gospel. It's Jesus's revealed by the Spirit. And all we're doing is letting it speak to the hearts of men and women today like it did then.
Yeah. And that gets back to verse 1, where Paul says, I'm a servant of Jesus, I'm called to be an apostle, and I'm set apart for the gospel of God. So it gets back to his authority. Yeah, absolutely. This is not something that Paul is making up on his own. Yep.
First, you show love, and then if someone's interested, that kind of opens
Yeah, definitely. Any other thoughts on 16 through 17? All right, 18 through 23. Would somebody like to read that? 18 through 23.
Yep. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made, so that they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools, and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images, resembling mortal man, and birds, and animals, and creeping things.
Okay. So we just talked about how Paul's not ashamed of the gospel. Then verse 18, for the wrath of God. Okay, time out. Sounds like Paul just made a horrendous transition here. Because we were talking about the gospel of Jesus, how he's not ashamed about that, and the righteousness of God. And then suddenly in verse 18, we're talking about God's anger. Did Paul just forget where he was when he put down the pen and just decided to pick up at a random place? What's going on here, do you think? Wait. Yeah, it's like Jason says, before the gospel is the best news you've ever heard, it's also the worst news you've ever heard. I can't say it better than that. I think part of the key to understanding this is in verse 18, it says the wrath of God is revealed, why? Against what? Against all ungodliness and unrighteousness. So in other words, godlessness and wickedness are the problems that he identifies here in verse 18. So notice what these two things are, godlessness and wickedness. What kind of relationships do those two things break? Godlessness, wickedness. You've got two different relationships. You've got a horizontal relationship between you and other people. If you're behaving wickedly and doing evil, there's a good chance that a lot of times you're going to be sinning against your brother. You're going to be sinning against other people. That's part of what wickedness is. Yes?
I got the New American Standard. It says ungodliness and unrighteousness.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, it's the same thing you're trying to do.
Yeah.
But when you're talking about ungodliness, mm-hmm. you're talking about attitude. Because you're godly,
yep.
it's not that you're not lying, but it's that you have the right kind of spirit, the right kind of attitude to do so.
Which I think is the main problem here is you're breaking the vertical relationship as well between God and yourself. So you're breaking that relationship. And think about what Jesus said are the greatest commands, is to love God with all your heart, mind, and soul, and to love your neighbor as yourself. And that's a lot of what you see happening in Romans chapter 1. Because you break, like Tony said, that vertical relationship between God and man, between God and yourself. Because you break that, then you cause a lot of the problems that you see in verses 24 through 32, which we'll get to in a moment. Then we get down to verse 21. It says, for although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their understanding and their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. So If you could put this in your own words, what do you think is the problem here? Looking at verse 21, what are people doing? What are the things? Sorry, James. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What we said is all about us. It's all about what our wants and our desires to be right now.
Yeah.
So that's what's happening with people here. So Paul describing is people are so wrapped up in themselves and their flesh, desire, just feel that red lust in the flesh.
Yeah, yeah. So one thing that jumps out at me here in verse 21 is that they said it says they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. Now, a lot of people might jump on this and think, well, it's kind of like you forgot to say thank you for a good meal, or you saw a sunset and forgot to tell God thank you. And I think the meaning is a lot deeper, closer to what James is talking about here. I think the problem is that, as one commentator says, we're being like cosmic plagiarists. We're taking the good gifts of God and we're assuming that we did that ourselves. We're responsible for what God has done. In other words, we're setting ourselves up as God. How do you know that? Okay, look at verse 23. What did the people do? They exchanged the glory of God for what? Images? What kind of images? For things that they had made. Yes. Yeah, exactly. At the end of the verse, it says birds and animals and creeping things. I don't know about you. That's kind of what I envision when I think about idols. But that's not the only thing he mentions. He also says that they exchanged the glory of God for images resembling mortal man. So they were making images essentially of people or things that looked like people and then worshiping them. So here's the problem. It's not just that they forgot to say thank you before they had a good meal. The problem is that they're setting themselves up as God. They're setting themselves up as a deity. And that's a large part of what you see going on here. Now, Tony, do you have a... Yeah.
You know, you can go back to anything. The second part of that, not just that you were guilty of ungodliness and unrighteousness, but because of that, it was an act.
Yeah.
And they were suppressing the truth. They're trying to suppress the truth.
Yeah.
And that's where this whole part starts here. Is that, you know, have this and then because you just look at it basically, we have a basic choice before us. Either we look to the evidence that God's provided that she is talking about here and we realize, hey, there's a God, there's something that I have there. We just put all this together. We need to learn more about it and give life to him.
Yeah.
I don't care. It's all about me and I'm going to go down this path and anybody gets in my way, I'm going to try to crush them.
Yeah.
That's what's I think he's getting at here, and it leads to all the stuff that you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. So what happens, and Tony's kind of set this up well, what happens when... sorry, what's that? Oh, perfect, perfect. So what happens when people decide to follow their own way, decide to set themselves up as the supreme authority in their lives? I think there are two things in the text that you can see happening, maybe more than two. I thought of two. One, people don't stop worshiping. I think one of the great myths that our culture has sold us is that it's possible for us to worship nothing. Like someone might say, well, you can believe in Christianity and they can believe in Islam, but I'm just neutral on all this. You're not neutral. That is an objective truth claim. If you believe that Christianity and Islam are both fine and a waste of God, that's a truth claim. There's also actually a theological name for it. It's called universalism. So you're always going to worship something. That's what you see with the Romans here in Romans chapter 1. They didn't worship God. They just exchanged God for something else. So you're always going to worship something. Two, as we look in the next couple verses, you'll see a transition. You'll see a transition from familiarity toward evil to vanity to idolatry to immorality. So familiarity with evil, they get accustomed to all the evil around them. Two, vanity, they become prideful and set themselves up as God, which is what we just talked about. Three, they actually indulge in idolatry. And then four, that ultimately produces immorality. I mean, think about it. when idol worship was set up in the Old Testament, have you ever noticed that usually tended towards immorality of some sort? I mean, when we talk about idol worship in the Old Testament, even in the New Testament, a lot of times we sanitize it for kids and say, well, they're just burning sacrifices to the idols. What else was involved in idol worship besides burning sacrifices? Yeah, sexual immorality was a part of a lot of worship services for ancient pagan gods. So you see this transition happening in Romans. You can even see it before Romans. You can see it after Romans. When you become familiar with evil, you become prideful, and don't do anything about it, you can become prideful. That can lead to idolatry of some sort, and ultimately to immorality. Now, verse 18, it's interesting to me. It says the wrath of God is being revealed. Now, when we think about God's judgment, I don't know about you, a lot of times I think about the ultimate judgment, like Judgment Day. But Paul doesn't say the wrath of God will be revealed, although in some sense I think it will be. He says the wrath of God is being revealed. So do you think there's any significance to that? Why would that matter, maybe? The wrath of God is being revealed.
Well, it goes back, I think, to the part of the gospel. The wrath of God is revealed in the gospel in the way that the punishment and judgment is executed upon Jesus.
Yeah. Yeah, so we've seen that in Jesus.
Also, too, you were talking about, you know, go back to what you talked about before, hey, you can't have, the gospel just isn't about, hey, here's the good news, here's what's saving you from.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it's James.
Well, it looks like in John 3:9, God denied August the same that God gave them up.
Yes.
Or gave them up.
Yes. So what do you think the highest value in our culture is? Yes, I think you're totally right. In our culture, what do you think the one moral absolute is, maybe the highest value could be? Yeah. Tolerate other people. Why? Why should you tolerate other people? What's the logic behind that? Yeah, I mean, the one moral absolute is be true to yourself. Whatever inclination or whatever lust, whatever desire you have, you've got to express that one way or another, or else you're not being true to yourself. Therefore, we must have tolerance. Okay, so let's relate this back to what James was saying about Romans 1, 18 through 24 or so. God is letting people have exactly what they want. Now, in our culture, you might think, oh, isn't this wonderful? We want all these things, and God is just letting us have it. Isn't the God of the Bible just wonderful? Isn't this exactly what we need? And the answer is no. Sometimes God letting you have exactly what you want can be a form of judgment. That's what you see in verse 24. God gave them up. Verse 26, God gave them up. So this is one way that we can see judgment being expressed. Think about it. I mean, what's the worst thing that you can give an alcoholic? More alcohol. What's the worst thing you can give someone who's addicted to work? Give him a promotion. I mean, what's the worst thing you can give someone who's addicted to sin and wants more of it? You give him, let him have more sin. So this is one way that we can see the wrath of God being revealed. C.S. Lewis said, there's this famous quote, there are those to whom God, those to who God say to God, thy will be done, and those to who God says, thy will be done. So it goes both directions. And then we get to verse 28 through 26 through 32. In broad terms, this is one of the questions I sent out. How would you categorize these sins? A lot of times we focus on specific types of sins. James, yes.
What we just said in Galatians chapter 5, works of the flesh.
Mm-hmm.
The complete works of the flesh is indulgence. And we have so many examples throughout the history of mankind of people who are completely indulgent at every desire fulfilled, the fleshly desire fulfilled. At the end of all of that, we don't understand that they're not happy. There's no joy. And a lot of times these people, instead of looking at it as a warning, we idolize it. We find their autobiography or their memoirs or think of them as, oh, this person was so great and they stuck out to you. No, there should be a warning to us that all of the things that I see in life are just vanity and empty. That's all that there is.
Yeah. How else would you categorize the sins in 24 through 32? We've talked about the motivation and the basis for them, and then here is the end result. I would categorize it a couple ways. One, there's economic disorder, there's social disorder, there's family breakdown, there's relational breakdown. Pretty much any kind of bond that you can imagine, anything that would point back to God, is ultimately breaking down. So this is getting back to what I talked about earlier. It's breaking the horizontal relationship between God and man. It's breaking both commands of Jesus to love God with all your heart, mind, and soul, love your neighbor as yourself. If you don't love God with all your heart, mind, and soul, then what's the result? Well, the result is what you see here in 24 through 32. So that is Romans chapter 1. I have about 1 minute left-ish. Other comments before we close? Other thoughts on Romans 1? All right. Next week we will be in Romans 2. Thank you for your comments. This has been fantastic, and I'll see you next week.